talk about something what we called spin-field correspondence. Actually, this is something that we introduced in a paper last month, and it bases on our previous work on something what we called nonlinear field space theory. So let me firstly say a few words about what the idea of nonlinear field space theory is, and then I will tell you how the idea of a spin field correspondence, which allows to merge spin systems with the field theories, appear. And then at the end, I will tell you about some applications, in particular to cosmology. So there will be some, just a bit of cosmology here as well. So let me start with the idea of nonlinear field space theory. And let me explain it on example of scalar field theory. So in the standard school version of field theory, scalar field theory, the scalar field is the state of field is described by two values at each point, namely the field value together with canonically conjugated momentum. So the phi and pi, pi forms the phase space, which is two-dimensional at every point. Basically, it means that you have a single harmonic oscillator at every point, which are coupled in the continuous limit. And in the classical version of the, or the standard version of the field theory, the phase space is flat. So the gamma x, which is the phase space at any point, is just r squared. So basically, it means that there is no constraint on the values of fields. They may go from minus to plus infinity, both regarding phi and pi. So this is the standard linear field theory that we usually deal with. So the nonlinear field space theory framework that we put forward earlier last year was to consider this linearity of the field space as an approximation to something more general. And in particular, we may think that the phase space of the field at each point is compact, as presented here. So actually, it's a possible way to implement regularization of the field. And another interesting consequences of that might be expected. In particular, you might think that maybe this way of bending the phase space is a way to resolve some problems of divergences in field theory. So that was our hope to study this this particular deformation. And actually, the motivation was simple. If it's something is flat and it's possible to bend it, why not to do it? Okay, so we just try to explore this new theory. But actually, the idea of curved phase space itself is not new. And there was a lot of inspirations in our head when we decided to follow this direction. And let me mention a few of them. So the first is the Born-Infeld theory introduced in late 30s of the last century, which was a way to resolve the problem of self-energy of an electron, namely in such a way that, that the infinite energy was related with the fact that we integrate over the field values, which might take infinite numbers. And therefore, Born-Infeld decided to put dynamical constraint on the field values just by modifying the Lagrange function such that not all the field values are allowed. And this is how the Born Infall theory emerged. And in fact, when you look into the original paper, you find a whole section about the principle of finiteness. So this was the idea they had in mind when introducing this work, namely to somehow implement the constraint on the fields to make the things finite as we like to have in the physical world. So, but in Born Infall theory, they put the constraints on the field values dynamically. In the nonlinear field space theory, we rather try to impose it at the kinematical level firstly, okay, and then the build dynamics such that it fits to the kinematics. So also, nonlinear field space theory might be viewed as something similar to the case of relativistic particle. We know that from the structure of space-time, that not all possible, not all velocities or the change of positions of the particles are possible. They are constrained actually at the kinematical level firstly, what is reflected thereafter at the level of the Lagrangian function or a Hamiltonian. But it means that, okay, we cannot change the position of particle as we like, okay, there is a constraint. But the thing is that maybe we think about something similar in case of fields. So maybe fields, usually they can change infinitely fast, okay? But maybe there is a constraint on the rate at which the field value changes, okay? And then nonlinear field space theory naturally implements this idea. Of course, there are lattice field theories where you deal with with the group elements which parameterize the phase of the field. So this might give you a something similar. But however, in the lattice field theories, you define the fields on the discrete lattice. In nonlinear field space theory, we can define the fields on the continuous manifold. Another thing are nonlinear sigma models, which were intensely studied in 60s and 80s. And in that case, we have a multi-component scalar field, and the curvature is introduced at the level of the field space, but not the full phase space, okay? So the relativistic symmetry was preserved, okay? So in our case, we generalize the notion to the whole phase space, and the curvature might be introduced also in case of a single scalar field model. And there is a Born reciprocity idea introduced firstly actually in the late 30s, but then there was a paper in the late 40s, which is a hypothesis that there is a symmetry within the position and momentum, okay? And physical theories might satisfy this symmetry. Of course, it's not always the case, and in case of the standard field theories, it's not. But such approaches like relative locality, approach to quantum gravity, try to incorporate this idea. And as I will show in a certain limit, actually the theory that we will deal with satisfies that Born reciprocity. Also, the polymer quantization is a sort of bending the phase space, actually. In loop quantum cosmology, you introduce polymerization, and actually this means at the semi-classical level that you bend the phase space to be a cylinder. So these are ideas are around. Sometimes we are not aware of this, but they are around. Also, last thing that I want to mention, but it's very important, it was important motivation as well, to try to understand something very basic, okay? Why the Hamiltonian of field theory looks as it is, okay? Why it's quadratic, okay? We know that in case of relativistic particle, or it, let's say, non-relativistic particle, we have quadratic contributions, but we know that they are coming from the Taylor development of the Lorentz factor. But of course, the Born-Infeld theory was to adopt the similarity from the relativistic physics to the field theory, but we know that the Born-Infeld theory is not fully fine. But may we think about the Hamiltonian and Lagrange functions and the quadratic terms contributing to the linear order and the interacting terms as a factors coming from development of some geometric expression, okay? And in our framework, we find that it's possible that actually the quadratic contributions originate from the scalar products, okay, which are or angles. So actually, in this framework, is possible to give such interpretation. So,
what's the problem with the Born-Infeld theory?
At the quantum level, if you construct the electrodynamics with the Born-Infeld theory, I don't think that it's renormalizable. I mean, it solves some problems, but some other problems emerge because if you Taylor expand thereafter everything, then you have an infinite series. You have basically non-polynomial functions. So in principle, there are some problems with this. So. Okay, so to be more concrete, let me focus. Okay. So you may think, of course, what this generalization of the phase space could be. Okay, it can be basically anything, any simplex thing, manifold. Okay, which is locally flat. But in the context of this idea of spin field correspondence, we found that. An interesting example, which is relevant and which is personally non-trivial and is locally flat, but additionally we have this spin field correspondence as something extra that we observe, is corresponding to the case of the spherical phase space. Okay, the sphere is. This is because the sphere is actually a phase space of angular momentum of spin, okay? And there is formally you can embed it in the so-called Kirilov orbit method. Actually, if you have a orbit which is the phase space of some G invariant the classical mechanical system, then the corresponding quantum mechanical system is described by irreducible representation of the G group. And in our case, the symmetry is SU2, and the orbit is a sphere. So it just means that the sphere is SU2 or SO3 invariant. Okay, so it embeds the symmetry. And so let's play with the sphere. And build a symplectic manifold based on that. So therefore, we have to equip the sphere with the symplectic form, and the natural choice of the symplectic form for the sphere is just the area form, okay? Because it's closed. And due to dimensional reasons, we have to introduce a multiplicative parameter, which is dimensionful, and it has dimension of angular momentum, okay, dimension of the phase space. So the symplectic form that we want to consider here is the following, written in the standard angular variables, okay, pi and theta. So let's focus on a single sphere right now, which would describe a field at a point, okay? So then we found relevant to switch to the q and pi variables, okay, in such a way that the origin of the q and pi system would correspond to the point on the equator, okay? just you can put it in any other Polynomial sphere. There is a symmetry, but it's convenient to work with such variables. But then, because these are dimensionless quantities and Q and pi are dimensionful, you need to introduce some two additional constants, which are thereafter fixed. So then you apply this change of coordinates to the symplectic form, and then your symplectic form takes this form. And additionally, to have a relation with the standard Darboux form, d pi, dq, we fix that R1 times R2 is equal S, okay? Then we have the relation to the standard notation that we usually use for mechanical systems or field theories. But you see that when R2 goes to infinity, so you increase the area of the sphere, then you recover the standard local expression for the Darboux form. But due to the curvature, there is this cosinus term in general. So having this form, I know that it's very simple, but let me start with the simple things to really catch the idea. The form is well-defined except the two poles, okay? And you can invert this form to get a Poisson tensor, so you can define the Poisson manifold. And the Poisson bracket looks like this, okay? So there is this additional 1 over cosine term in front of the standard expression. So in particular for the canonical variables, Q and pi, you have the following bracket satisfied. So there is deformation with respect to the classical case, which is this 1 over cosine term, which either in the limit when R2 goes to infinity, so it means that the spin value, the S will be associated with a spin thereafter, goes to infinity, or you consider very small deviations of the field or of this variable from the origin of the coordinate system. Of course, having the Poisson bracket, you can define dynamics just by introducing the Hamiltonian. And one more thing, I mean, this Q and P variables are not globally defined, okay? Of course, in the vicinity of the origin, everything is fine, okay? But you have to keep in mind that with Q, you go to basically minus pi 2 and then minus pi 2, so there is some discontinuity here, and with the P as well. And especially in the context of quantum considerations, when you deal with the compact topologies, it's not very handy to work with variables which are not globally defined. But for a sphere, there is natural choice for the globally defined functions, and these are the components of the angular momentum vector S, okay, which is just Cartesian parametrization of a sphere. So we introduce the angular momentum vector S, which is initially expressed in terms of theta and phi variables as usual, but thereafter you might re-express the theta and phi variables in terms of P and Q variables, such that the relations looks like that. And then it will be useful for us because we will be studying what is happening in the vicinity of the origin, and we will do the analysis in the leading order. Therefore, I Tyler expand these functions to the leading contributions. And moreover, of course, because it's a sphere, that, that the additional condition is satisfied, so that the sum of squares sum up to a square. And just to prove that we actually have to do with spin, you can take these functions, you can take the Poisson bracket that we derived before and directly compute the Poisson bracket between the components, and you will find that this is they are satisfying the SU2 algebra as expected. So let's say that this is kinematics of a sphere. Let me right now pass to a simple example of dynamics, and the simplest example that we can imagine here in this context is the spin precession. So just for spin, the Hamiltonian is zero, but to have something non-vanishing, you have to immerse the spin in some field, or as in magnetic field, and introduce some interaction. So the simplest choice of the Hamiltonian, the very well known from school, is the interaction of the angular momentum with the external magnetic field B, which is just the scalar product. And then having this Hamiltonian, we can, of course, using the Poisson bracket that we have and the phase space that we have, derive equations of motions, and which are in this case the precession equations, okay, which describe precession of the spin vector around the B vector. This is the let's say the easy part. But then we would like to actually describe what's happening around the origin of the Q pi coordinate system. If we want to describe what is happening around the Q and pi origin, then we would like to enforce the S vector to be oriented somewhere in the direction of B, and oscillate around this let's say equilibrium point. Therefore, for this reason, but this comes from the fact that we have chosen the Q and pi variables as they are. If we would choose them differently, we would have to point the vector in the different direction. But then the B vector has to be directed along the X axis. And then in that case, you see that from the Hamiltonian, only the Sx factor contributes. So your H is just Sx times Bx. And we know that the development of the Sx component is as written here. The Poisson dart doesn't work anymore. So it's basically 1 minus pi p square over 2 r2 square, and et cetera. So then you see that the Hamiltonian of spin precession for the small angles between the spin vector and the B vector is described by the harmonic oscillator, okay? It's something what we could expect, of course. And here we have the original variables mu and Bx and R2 and R1, but we can rename the parameters just for convenience to have to see that it's really similar, such that it looks like the Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillator. Of course, there are also higher order terms which contribute if our departure from the equilibrium is bigger. But in the leading order, you just recover the standard harmonic oscillator, and the pictorial representation of this is very simple. So you have a sphere here, and you have a S vector. So when the vector S is oscillating, then the top of the vector encircles a circle at the sphere, which is in the linear approximation also a circle at the tangent plane, which is just an approximation to the phase space. Okay, so that the circle at the sphere is at the same time a circle in the QP plane, okay? But the QP plane is a phase space. As the sphere is the phase space too. So the circle in the phase space is just an oscillation, okay? So this is the picture for a single degree of freedom, okay? This identification works. And right now, you might think about generalizing this idea to the set of spins, which will, in the leading order, describe the harmonic oscillators, okay? So let me study one. Okay, this is still the identification, okay? So if you want to go from a single degree of freedom to a set of continuous set of degrees of freedom, you introduce this identification. So the Q will be our phi at x and p, and p is a pi, phi. So these are our new canonically conjugated variables. And one important issue to stress is that this identification is possible just because that the dimension of sphere, which is a phase space, is the same as the dimension of a phase space of a scalar field at point. So this is the second inequality, which is fundamental here. But right now, okay, you have a kinematics. You know that you can build such identification. But right now, the question is, what kind of system, spin system, corresponds to the field theories that we have, that we deal with every day. So I started in this short December paper, I started with studying the XXX Heisenberg model. So this is the simplest Heisenberg model from high school, okay? In this case, interaction between all the components of the spins are just the same. There is no anisotropy. But it turns out that this XXX Heisenberg model leads to non-relativistic scalar field theory. However, and this is something what we are studying with my collaborators from Shanghai, is that when you introduce anisotropy to the model, and this is known in condensed matter physics as XXZ model, which is intensely studied in the context of superfluid systems in particular, then you might generate you might get a relativistic field theory. And this is something what I want to show you right now. So the discrete version of the Hamiltonian I want to study is this. Okay, this is the starting point for our considerations. So the delta enters here in front of the Z interactions. So when delta is equal to 1, you get the standard XXX Heisenberg model. Of course, as usual in the Heisenberg model, we assume that the interaction is only with the neighbors, okay? B is the external magnetic field, as in the previous example. So we have both interaction between the spins, the neighbor spins, and interaction with external magnetic field. And right now, the first thing that we have to do when we pass to the field theory is that we do the continuous limit, okay? So the continuous limit is standard to perform, okay? You just write one index, okay, you rename the indices to be not discrete by continuous, and go to the continuous limit. And in the continuous limit, you just have a sum of squares of the nablas of the components and the interaction term. The new field of parameters are the continuous version of the previous parameters. So this is the continuous XXZ model. And the next step is to is to apply the relation between the x components and the phi and the pi components. So for this purpose, firstly, we know that in order to make use of these new coordinates as they are introduced, we have to point out the B field along the x axis. So therefore, from this term, we will have contribution from the Sx only. And actually, this Xx will lead, because there will be Q in the old variables, there will be Q square and the P square. So they will lead to this term, and they lead to this term. But this interaction terms, okay, this kinetic terms, leads to the second and the fourth contributions, okay, in the leading order. And for convenience, I renamed the parameters such that M is right now mu bar times bx, and these are the other relations which have to be satisfied to get the first three terms to have precisely the shape that we usually consider, okay? But as you see, there is something additional, okay? There is additional term which is multiplied by this delta parameter, okay? So when this delta parameter is equal to 1, you will have a contribution from the term which is actually symmetric to the standard kinetic term, which is in the Hamiltonian. However, such theory is non-relativistic because the pi's the momentum is not only contributing to the Hamiltonian as a pi square, but also with this additional term. But actually, this Hamiltonian is very symmetric, and the symmetry is just because of the symmetry of the initial Hamiltonian with respect to rotations. However, we can break the symmetry by playing with delta. And I told you at the beginning that we see reciprocity in some limit, and this is precisely when delta is equal to 1. When delta is equal to 1, you have a symmetry of changing phi to pi and pi to phi. And the symmetry is the following. If you change phi for pi phi over m and pi phi for minus phi times m, nothing changes, okay? So the Hamiltonian is symmetric with respect to such duality symmetry. So not only the Hamiltonian, but also in the limit when s go to infinity, that the symplectic form stays invariant. But this is a very special case. We don't know whether this case has any relation to observable universe, okay? Because at the scales we usually deal with, the fields are relativistic and do not satisfy this symmetry, okay? But maybe in some other configurations, okay, it is. So I'm not going to consider the case with delta equal 1. I want to consider the case when delta goes to 0, actually, okay? So, but to better see what are the consequences of this additional term which contributes to the Hamiltonian, let's study the dynamics. So the Poisson bracket right now is a field theoretical analog of what we have seen at the beginning. So there is 1 over cosine here, and there are functional derivatives. And then when you derive the equations of motions, there is, I mean, this additional symmetric term contributes symmetrically, okay? So usually there is nothing there, but here there is additional lambda, nabla times by phi term. So then combining these two equations, you can derive an analog of the Klein-Gordon equation, and what you find is that this extra term contributes in two places. The first one is in front of the Laplace operator, just as a constant. So actually, this is roughly the speed of propagation. And there is another contribution with the higher order derivative term, okay? So the standard relativistic case, standard Klein, massive Klein-Gordon equation is recovered when delta goes to zero. And actually this case, when delta goes to zero, is very relevant physically in the condensed matter system. It corresponds to, at a quantum level, to XX or XY models, which are descriptions of the superconducting matter states, such that in the condensed matter system, the interaction between the Z components of the spins is damped. Okay. So you might see that the condensed matter system described by the XX or XY Heisenberg model is equivalent, is dual in the description to the relativistic scalar field. But let me study slightly more the case when delta is in general not vanishing, or it's close to zero. And for this purpose, let's perform the Fourier transform of this equation, okay? To get dispersion relation, okay? To see how the dispersion relation in this case looks like. And the dispersion relation turns out to be of this form, that the fourth derivative produces k to the four term, okay, which is here. And then the dispersion relation can be written in this way as a classical contribution multiplied by this non-standard term. And then you can find what is the group velocity, what is the propagation, and what is the phase velocity as well. So usually the group velocity, I mean, the standard theory, group velocity times phase velocity is one, it's constrained. In our case, it's one plus something, okay, which might be actually both greater on or smaller than one, depending on what the delta is, okay? But if delta is equal to zero, you recover the standard field theory. So this is basically the linear order of the scalar field that we get from this dual description. Actually, this is the field theory derived from the Heisenberg model. But this is done for the scalar field. Okay, this is an example for scalar field. And we know that it can be done. Right now, what we are doing is that we are studying the interaction terms which appear here. But you may think that, or you may ask a question if it's possible to generalize this picture to the other types of fields. Okay, whether we can construct spinor fields or vector fields or other higher spin fields out of this. And it turns out that it seems to be that it's possible. I mean, there is no fundamental reason why it should not, at least for these fields that I pointed out here. And how to do it, namely, the single degree of freedom corresponding to this single scalar field is just a one spin per point. If you want to have 2 degrees of freedom per point, you put at every point two different spins. So in condensed matter system, it corresponds to the situation when in your lattice element, you have two different atoms with two different spins, and they interact each other, and they interact with neighbors as well. And of course, the form of the interaction determines what the shape of your Hamiltonian of the given field theory would be. if you have massless fields, for any type of the fields here, you need only 2 degrees of freedom. So you need only 2 spins per point or per cell in the discrete case. And of course, depending on what the interaction is, you might design the interaction between the spins such that it will give you a certain field theory, okay? And this is something what we are working on currently. So the one application of this, direct application of this picture is that having a given field theory, you may design condensed matter system which will represent this field theory, and then you might study experimentally some effects actually in this analog system. And this is one application. Another application might be more fundamental, because you might ask a question, okay, if you can construct fields that we know out of spins, and we perceive a spin as something very fundamental, and it appears in the different approaches to quantum gravity, and this is something we actually still don't understand what it is really. And the possibility that emerges here is that maybe we can build the fields, the matter and the interaction fields out of this elementary spins, which are somewhere at the bottom. Okay, so this is something hypothetical. Okay, I don't know whether it's possible, whether there are no fundamental reasons why it should not work. Okay, but at least such possibility within this framework emerges. So this is the, let's say, the correspondence. Let me tell a few words about the applications that we may have. And let me focus on something what we are working on currently, namely, is that we want to apply, we have a scalar field which is different than the usual field when you go to the large field values. And there is no much place actually in physics when we deal with scalar field. And one potential example is the inflatoned field. So the natural place when we can try to apply the framework is the early universe. And because we might generate inflationary periods with use of the single massive scalar field, which is our leading order contribution actually to the Hamiltonian. So so this is something what we are studying at the moment, and then the Hamiltonian of the scalar field might be written like that, such that in the leading order, when you expand everything, you have the standard contribution, but you have also higher order terms. And dynamics is in general very complicated. I mean, in the vicinity of the zero zero point, the origin of the coordinate system, everything is like in the classical cosmology. But when you consider a general dynamics on a sphere, actually of the S vector, your equations of motions are looking like that. Okay, so you have equations for all the x components, then you have evolution of q, which is a q is a volume element, is basically scale factor to the power of 3, and the p is proportional to the Hubble factor. I use this q and p parameters here to parameterize the cosmological degrees of freedom, but the matter degrees of freedom are parameterized by sx, ay, and sz. Okay. And in general, you have very complicated system of equation, and something what we are working on right now is to understand really the dynamics, because we thought that the dynamics will be very simple, that the spin will go around and then you will have the standard inflationary phase, but it turns out that there's a lot of structure which appears there due to this complicated dynamics. We study this issue numerically at the moment. And another thing, what we are working on right now in the context of cosmology is that we apply this field to study perturbations as well. So here, what I'm talking about is the background dynamics, but you might also perturb this field. And we perturb this field together with this extra term multiplied by delta. And this leads to additional structures, and the vacuum normalization is different. There's a lot of things that we are working on right now in this direction, and it will be in the coming paper on the nonlinear field space cosmology. So I think I had some additional slides actually on the analysis that we've done in our first paper published at the beginning of last year. I mean, the first one when we started to investigate the approach of nonlinear field space theory. And in that paper, we did the calculations not in the space representation, but in the Fourier representation. So also, quite a lot of calculations were possible to perform in that paper. So let me only briefly summarize some of the conclusions. So the first conclusion that that appears here is that due to the fact that this algebra of canonically conjugated variables is different than the standard one. There is no one but one over cosine, okay? In the leading order, yeah?
I have just a question on the last slide.
The previous one, yeah.
It's a bit technical, but so the Poisson brackets that you postulate in the Fourier representation.
It's for the sphere. It's for the sphere.
No. My question is whether they come from the same Poisson brackets that you
exactly. But
that you postulated in positions.
Exactly. It's for the sphere. It's for the sphere as well. Okay, but I'm not showing some details here, just to make things short. But if you go to the Fourier space, you don't have special derivatives. Special derivatives produces your k squared terms, okay? So in that case, only the following Hamiltonian can be used to generate this Hamiltonian. Then you have one more thing. Instead of using the standard complex variables for pi and phi here, we used the variables which are real. So you perform a canonic transformation to get real variables, because it's easier, it's more handy to work with them. And for the standard, you have k and minus k bar. Here you have it with plus. I can show you if you like how it works. It's a very simple trick. So in that case, what appears is that if you want to quantize perturbatively this theory in the order proportional to 1 over s, actually, because your commutation relation between the phi and pi is modified, the composition for annihilation and creation operators has to be deformed as well. And the only way to do that is such that the algebra of the commutation and annihilation operators is Q deformed, actually. And the Q deformation parameter in the leading order is of this form, such that when S goes to infinity, everything's becoming classical. So because of that, of course, the phase space has finite dimension, and the finite dimension comes from the fact that you can accommodate only finite number of degrees of freedom at the sphere because it's compact phase space. So you have finite number of 2 pi h bar cells. And but you can introduce action of creation and annihilation parameters, operators, sorry, and perturbatively diagonalize things. But we did it for one reason, actually. We wanted to find expression for the propagator. Okay, so we derived in the leading order expression for the propagator in this framework. And the propagator, the dispersion relation might be inferred from the pole of the propagator. And what we find from this is that you see that it's still linear actually, but there is additional correction to the spin of propagation. And in case where S is a constant is the same for every mode, because the generalization you may think about is that for different modes, you have the different phase spaces parameterized by a different S parameter. But if you keep the conformal symmetry, because you don't distinguish between the different modes, okay, you preserve linear dispersion relation as expected, but only the speed of propagation is rescaled, okay? And we verified it at the leading order. And also based on that, we computed what is the interaction between the two field sources interacting through this field with this additional effect. And we find that the potential of interaction is of the Coulomb form, but also the charge is rescaled by this factor, okay? So, and it's good because the functional structure doesn't change if S is not a function of K, because then for every mode you have the same phase space, the physics is the same at each scale, so you don't break conformal invariants, so your scaling of the potential is 1 over R. Are like for the vector field or gravitational waves. So, but you have some rescalings of the or renormalization of the couplings. In case your S would be a function of K, if you would introduce such model, then you would have deformation of the dispersion relation. It would not be linear, and consequently, after performing this integration, the potential of interaction would be modified as well. So let me summarize. So that something what we call nonlinear field space theory, ST actually, NF, ST not TS, it's a viewpoint where we perceive the standard field theories as an approximation to some more general thing with the curved field space. And actually the compactness of the field space allows to implement the principle of finiteness, what I very like personally, because I like to have finite things. And the world is finite. And this is a way to implement it. And we have this for the special case of the spherical, because I was not discussing other phase spaces. I was focused here on the spherical case. You can consider torus, other possible phase spaces. But for the special choice, I mean the spherical phase space, we have this additional benefit, which is relation to the spin physics, okay? And this is at the core of the spin field correspondence. Something to be done, and what is in progress, is to generalize it to the different types of fields, something what is in principle possible to do. There's actually a lot of interesting predictions. And I was not discussing it, but also due to the fact that the commutation relation is different than the usual, the uncertainty relation is modified, and we have the Q deformations of algebra. So a lot of things which were actually studied in the context of quantum gravity as well appear here due to this geometric origin. And the number of maximal occupation number is confined, is bounded due to the fact that the phase space is compact. Also, we have, I was not showing this, but you can see in our the first paper we published on this subject, is that the vacuum energy is also shifted. As I discussed in the model, the XXZ model, the deformation of the Lorentz covariance is also obtained. So based on that, you might think about applications and building relations with condensed matter physics. I still don't know whether it might be really useful or not. Okay, this is something I don't know. But I hope that maybe it will find some application to condensed matter physics as well, because sometimes you might transform the condensed matter system physics into the language that you already well know, okay? And you have a methods which can be applied thereafter, okay? And also something what interests me and something what we are working on right now is the application of cosmology as an example of application of the framework. Thank you. Do you have, guys, any questions or comments? Any critics?
So it seems that you have this fundamental parameter S, which somehow seems to be a fundamental constant in this approach, right? Which has the same dimensions as H bar.
Yeah.
So how am I supposed to think about this in terms of, the scale?
First,
that
it has to be it has to be big, because I mean, in order to describe the standard field theory, okay, when you have your occupation number is big, okay, you can have multiparticle states. The S has to be big enough, okay, to accommodate enough degrees of freedom at your phase space, okay. Therefore, S cannot be just 1/2, okay? Because for 1/2, you will not get, even in this classical description, any physics, okay, which will correspond to the standard. Therefore, S has to be big. This is something what we know, okay? It has to be H bar, but times to 10 to the something, I don't know, from experimental physics, I don't know what the constraints are actually. But I don't know. Maybe there are two H bars in nature, one small, one big. I don't know. Okay.
Okay, if not, let's
thank you. Thank you. Thank you.